There are certain things we associate with safety and comfort. A childhood bedroom. A mother's embrace. A warm, clean motel room after a long drive through the rain. A hot shower at the end of the day. Over the course of 2 hours, Norman Bates destroyed these comforts for an entire generation. Welcome to Villains, a Parcast original. I'm Alistair Murden. On this show, we look at the world's most infamous villains, both real and imagined. We aim to understand how villainy translates from history into our greatest fictional stories. You can find episodes of Villains and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Villains for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Villains into the search bar. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help us. This is episode 5 of 10 on postmodern psychopaths. Our first two fictional villains were cold-blooded assassins who killed without remorse. But this week, we're looking at a character who's a little bit different. Someone who doesn't want to kill, but is powerless to stop himself. By the strictest definition, Norman Bates, the primary villain in Alfred Hitchcock's famed 1960 film Psycho, is not a psychopath. More accurately, the title Psycho would refer to psychosis, a break with reality that's a symptom of several different mental conditions. In this case, dissociative identity disorder. The DSM-5 defines this disorder as disruption of identity characterized by two or more distinct personality states. For Bates, this second identity takes the form of his deceased mother. And while Norman Bates, the original personality, is a sweet, unassuming young man, the mother personality is a force of pure evil. Not unlike Anton Chigurh and Villanelle, this darker side of Bates is driven to kill by a singular impulse. But that guiding principle isn't fate or retribution or pleasure. It's self-destruction. The mother's only wish is to isolate Norman from anyone else who might care for him, to keep him inside the abusive trap he was born into. What makes Bates such a compelling character is that he is both the villain and the victim, the mother and the son, the psychopathic murderer and the helpless bystander. Our fear comes from the fact that all of these dichotomies can exist inside the same body. To understand what Norman Bates became, we have to go back to the very beginning. This is a tall order, since the Psycho franchise spans 2 novels, 6 movies, and a TV series, none of which adhere to the same version of events. For simplicity, we're going to focus mainly on the 1960 film directed by Alfred Hitchcock, because it's had the greatest impact on our culture. According to the film's timeline, Norman Bates would have been born sometime in the early 1930s. His father died when he was 5 years old, leaving him alone with his mother, Norma. From then on, Norma and Norman lived in total isolation in the rural outskirts of Fairvale, California, with no neighbors, no visitors, and only the rare guest at their property, the Bates Motel. And that isolation bred dependence. Norma was controlling, and she demanded complete obedience from her son. As he grew up, he was never allowed near girls, as Norma believed that all women were morally corrupt harlots. More than anything, she raised Norman to believe that no one could ever love him, except for her. And as a result, it's implied that Norman developed sexual feelings for his mother. The story's incestuous themes are more obvious in the original novel by Robert Bloch, but at the behest of the Hollywood Censor Board, they were toned down significantly in the film. Nevertheless, screenwriter Joseph Stefano saved some of the scenes he and Hitchcock had discussed for Norman's backstory, and later worked them into the 1991 made-for-TV sequel, Psycho 4. This includes one rather bizarre scene where the shirtless, teenage Norman dabs perfume onto his mother's legs. After a prolonged, sensuous moment, she flips him over onto the bed and begins tickling him. Then, when she realizes Norman has become sexually aroused, she's irate. To scare away Norman's masculine sexual impulses, Norma forces him to put on one of her dresses, smears lipstick on his face, and locks him in a closet, screaming, "You'll stay locked in there until you accept that you're a girl." There's a lot to unpack here. To begin, we need to look at the dominant theory of development in the 1950s. Psychoanalysis. Sigmund Freud divided childhood into five different stages. Any kind of distress during a certain stage would cause a corresponding psychological problem. Norman's father died when he was in the third phase of development, the phallic stage, between ages 3 and 6. This is when children become aware of the difference between male and female, and the child learns to identify with the parent of their own gender. According to Freud, as soon as a young boy realizes that he is a boy and his mother is a girl, he begins to project feelings of sexual desire onto her and, in turn, to feel jealousy toward his father. This is called the Oedipus complex, named for the character from Greek mythology who unwittingly killed his father and married his mother. The only way for the child to resolve this conflict is by identifying with their father and seeing him as a role model instead of a rival. But because of his father's death, Norman Bates had no male figure to identify with. Instead, he was conditioned to identify with his mother. His unresolved Oedipus complex became entangled with his own gender identity. While Freud's theories have been soundly disproven today, they were widely accepted during the 1950s. This Oedipal theme is referenced explicitly in the original novel Psycho, and it clearly informed the film series as well. And for audiences, it's crucial in making sense of what happens next. When Norman was a teenager, his mother met a man. Suddenly, a third person had entered the private orbit of the Bates household. Norma had cut her son off from any other human relationships. He had no one and nothing else. And now, she was tossing him aside for someone new. As Norman later said, "A son is a poor substitute for a lover." So his Oedipal instinct kicked in. In a fit of jealous rage, Norman poisoned both his mother and her lover. The deaths were presumed to be a murder-suicide. The shy teenage Norman was never a suspect. But the guilt drove him mad. He couldn't live with what he had done. And after a lifetime alone with no one but his mother, he had no idea how to function without her. So, to mentally cope, he erased the murder from his mind. In a sudden onset of delusion, he convinced himself that his mother was still alive. And thus began his metamorphosis into a new kind of villain. No longer the jealous Oedipus, he became a cold-blooded maniac, driven by impulses that even he himself could barely understand. After the funeral, which was held at the Bates house, Norman took his mother's body out of the coffin and hid it in the cellar. He weighted the coffin down with books, and it was buried in the local cemetery with no one the wiser. Norman preserved his mother's body with taxidermy to slow the decay. He kept her in the house, washed and changed her clothes, and had imaginary conversations with her. Over time, this imagined mother began to take on a life of its own. Norman spoke for her, thought for her. Soon, he was dressing like her, putting on her old dresses and donning wigs and makeup to transform himself into a woman. Eventually, there were spells when this second personality completely took over Norman's consciousness. When he woke up, he would have no idea what had happened while Mother was in control. Until he looked around and saw the blood. Norman's imagined version of his mother was just as possessive as the real woman. In a cruel reversal of the Oedipus complex, as soon as he began feeling attraction to someone, Mother would sense the competition, take over, and stab the other woman to death. The exact stories vary, depending on which prequels and sequels you accept, but in his late teens and early 20s, Norman killed at least two women he was romantically interested in. And in the events of the movie Psycho, the same fate would befall a young secretary named Marion Crane. Coming up, we'll look at one of the most famous murder scenes in movie history. Now back to the story. After murdering his mother, Norman Bates fell into a spiral of guilt and denial that eventually led to a dissociative break from reality. His consciousness fractured into two distinct identities, his regular personality and a violent delusion of his late mother. Even from beyond the grave, the domineering Mrs. Bates exerted control over her son, possessing his body and murdering any woman who dared to compete for his affection. This finally brings us up to the events of the 1960 movie Psycho. About 10 years after Mrs. Bates' death, when Norman is in his late 20s, a woman named Marion Crane arrives at the Bates Motel. She's just stolen $40,000 from her employer and fled town, and she stops off at the motel in the midst of a bad rainstorm. The motel's 12 rooms are all vacant. As Norman explains, once a new highway was built elsewhere, all the traffic through the area disappeared. He and his bedbound mother live completely alone in the house next to the motel. Since the weather is too bad to make it back into town, Norman invites Marion to have dinner at the house. He heads over to prepare the food, and Marion goes into her room to get settled. All the way from her window, Marion can hear Norman's mother screaming at him inside the house. She yells, "I won't have you bringing strange young girls in for supper. Go tell her she'll not be appeasing her ugly appetite with my food or my son. Or do I have to tell her because you don't have the guts?" This is our first introduction to the Bates family in the film. From his first moment on screen, Norman comes off as a gentle, soft-spoken young man. A first-time viewer would have no idea that his belligerent mother doesn't actually exist. We, like Marion, want to sympathize with him. And this is what makes him so dangerous. As we'll see, time and again, people refuse to believe that Norman is capable of violence. He seems so harmless. In fact, actor Anthony Perkins described his character by saying, "He would not plot malice against anyone. He has no evil or negative intentions. The idea that a darker force could be lurking inside him is incomprehensible. So while they eat dinner in the motel parlor, Marion brushes off the red flags that Norman isn't as harmless as he appears. For one, the parlor is absolutely covered in taxidermied birds. As Norman bluntly explains, "My hobby is stuffing things." The way the birds are positioned within the frame reinforces the dichotomy within Norman, who is both the predator and the victim. A large owl, a bird of prey, is mounted on the wall above Norman, but surrounding him on the tables are small, harmless songbirds. Then, when Norman begins talking about his mother, the camera angle changes. Now all we see is the owl hovering above Norman's head with its outstretched wings filling the frame. The mother is the bird of prey, a natural threat to the defenseless songbirds that symbolize the other side of Norman's personality. At this point, it's obvious to Marion and to the audience that Norman is a bit disturbed. But as film critic David Thompson points out, as soon as we feel that, he gives us one of his deprecating chuckles or boyish smiles. He knows too, doesn't he? He's got it under control. So we trust him, despite our better judgment. As the conversation continues, Norman explains that he can't leave the motel and live a life of his own, even if he wanted to. His mother is ill, mentally ill, it's implied, and if he left, there would be no one to take care of her. He says, "The fire would go out. It'd be cold and damp like a grave. If you love someone, you don't do that to them, even if you hate them." Once again, it seems that, on some level, Norman is aware of his delusion. He even clarifies, "I don't hate her. I hate what she's become. I hate the illness." And yet, he still can't let go of his mother or of what she's become. As Norman explains, we're all in our private traps, clamped in them, and none of us can ever get out. We scratch and claw, but only at the air, only at each other. And for all of it, we never budge an inch. Marion suggests, sometimes we deliberately step into those traps. But Norman replies, "I was born in mine." On the first viewing, the audience assumes, like Marion, that the trap he's caught in is his relationship with his mother. She suggests that he could simply put his mother in an institution and let someone else take care of her. But this, of course, is no solution, because Norman and his mother are unfortunately sharing a body. Norman's response suggests that he actually has spent time in a mental institution. Have you ever seen the inside of one of those places? The laughing and the tears and the cruel eyes studying you. Clearly, whatever treatment he received did nothing to help him. Despite his self-awareness and his desire to change, Norman sees no possible way to be free. By the end of the conversation, we and Marion feel nothing but sympathy for the traumatized young man. But that sympathy is misplaced, because this sweet, gentle side is only one half of his personality. After dinner, Marion goes back to her room to take a shower. Norman removes a painting from the parlor wall and gazes through a secret peephole into her room, watching her undress. This transgression brings the possessive mother back into control. While Marion is in the shower, a shadowy figure sneaks into the bathroom. Through the curtain, we see the silhouette of an old woman raise a knife and stab Marion to death. We, as the audience, don't see what Marion would have seen in her final moments. That old woman is actually Norman Bates, wearing a wig and a dress. Sometime later, Norman comes back to reality and he's shocked to find Marion's bloody corpse on the bathroom floor. He knows that Mother has killed again. So to protect her and to protect himself, he dutifully cleans up the blood and disposes of Marion's body. The cleaning sequence is quiet and drawn out. It restores a sense of calm while also keeping the audience's mind on the murder that just occurred. We are here with Norman, and we too want to see the crime erased and order restored. Thus, we identify with him, and his guilt becomes our guilt. As researcher Stephen Rebello explains, the idea was to make each audience member an active conspirator in the agony. Our surface-level fear of the crazy woman in the House of Horrors has been replaced by a deeper, existential dread. The villain is now our sole protagonist, and we are all complicit in his crimes. But this is far from the end of the story. A private investigator named Milton Arbogast has been looking for Marion. With the help of Marion's boyfriend Sam and sister Lila, Arbogast manages to track her last location to the Bates Motel. When Arbogast arrives to question Norman, our complicity is tested. Film scholar Joseph W. Smith III describes the scene as a conflict between wanting to see justice done and hoping Norman can get off the hook. On a moral level, the detective is the valiant hero trying to uncover the horrible crime we witnessed moments earlier. But on an emotional level, Norman is the one we root for. Before Arbogast enters, Norman's munching on a bag of candy corn, an adorable touch improvised by actor Anthony Perkins. He stutters desperately through the interrogation, appearing more vulnerable than ever. According to Smith, scenes like this are the source of the film's deepest horror. It's not the fear of death or attack, it's the fear of being found out, of being discovered in the act of doing something wrong. While talking to Norman in the motel lobby, Arbogast notices the silhouette of an old woman sitting in the window of the house next door. He asks to speak to her, but Norman refuses, and the detective eventually leaves. But a few hours later, Arbogast comes back. He sneaks into the Bates home to investigate, and he meets the same fate as Marion. When Arbogast fails to return, Marion's boyfriend Sam and sister Lila decide to take the investigation into their own hands. They visit the Bates Motel, check in under false names, and scour the place for evidence that Marion and Arbogast had been there. Lila goes down into the fruit cellar, where she finds Mrs. Bates' decaying corpse sitting in a chair. Finally, the truth is revealed to the audience. The old woman hovering behind Lila with a knife is actually Norman, wearing a wig and one of his mother's dresses. Once again, Norman, as Mother, tries to stab Lila, but Sam appears and manages to wrestle the knife away from him. Sam and Lila survive, and finally, Norman is arrested. We cut to the courthouse, where a psychiatrist is recounting his interview with Norman to the chief of police. The mother personality now seems to have completely taken over Norman's consciousness. The psychiatrist concludes that, To erase the guilt of his mother's murder, Norman developed a split personality. He explains, when the mind houses two personalities, there's always a conflict, a battle. In Norman's case, the battle is over, and the dominant personality has won. Finally, the identity crisis has been resolved. It's certainly a tragic ending, but it's a conclusion we can cope with. The innocent Norman is gone. What remains is only the cold-blooded killer. At least, that's what the psychiatrist character would have us believe. According to Stephen Rebello, the main purpose of this scene was to help get the film past the censors. They could only get away with the risque subject matter by wrapping it up with a neat clinical explanation. The scene was shot in exactly one take, after which Hitchcock shook the actor's hand and said, "Thank you very much, Mr. Oakland. You've just saved my picture." Rebello describes the psychiatrist as someone who knew the facts, but never actually got the whole picture. Fittingly, the final scene completely undercuts his tidy psychoanalytic theory. In the final scene, Norman sits alone in an empty cell with a blanket wrapped around his shoulders, an image that evokes both a child bundling up in the cold and an old woman wearing a shawl. Mother's voice speaks over the image. She says, "I couldn't allow them to believe that I would commit murder. He intended to tell them I killed those girls and that man, as if I could do anything except sit and stare like one of his stuffed birds. They know I can't even move a finger." In the final image, Norma's decayed skull is briefly juxtaposed over Norman's face. There is no one or the other. They are one in the same. What's troubling about this ending is that it shatters any conception of black and white morality. We mentioned that these first 10 episodes are focused on postmodern psychopaths. Postmodernism was a movement in the mid to late 20th century that questioned the universal concepts of truth and morality. Put simply, this philosophy suggests that everything is relative and binary modes of thinking, like good versus evil, are inherently flawed. Today, this idea is widely accepted. Our first two villains, Anton Chigurh and Villanelle, live inside that moral ambiguity quite easily. But in 1960, this rejection of traditional morals was still controversial. Psycho boldly pushed the limits of what was acceptable with unprecedented amounts of violence, sexual content, and otherwise taboo material. It flew in the face of the infamous Hays Code, which specified that the sympathy of the audience should never be thrown to the side of crime, wrongdoing, evil, or sin. The penultimate scene with the psychiatrist serves as a sort of concession to this moral pushback. Order has been restored, and our fear of that uneasy moral middle ground has been contained. But upon closer examination, this comforting theory falls apart. The dichotomy within Norman persists, even if we refuse to acknowledge it. And with this lack of resolution, our guilt and complicity is made all the more powerful. On its own, this disturbance in the moral binary would make for a compelling horror story. But there's another blurred boundary we need to mention. According to author Robert Bloch, Norman's first name is a combination of two words, Norman, a pun which contains the secret of the story. My killer is neither woman nor man. The concept of gender identity as anything separate from binary biological sex was only beginning to emerge at the time of Psycho's production. There was no framework to understand Norman Bates except the flawed psychoanalytic theory which the film itself had just discredited. And that unresolved conflict between male and female threatened the entire social structure America depended on. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at the mother and son relationship between Norman and Norma Bates, and what it means for the story's gender dynamics. Now back to the story. The ending of Psycho defies the division between Norman and Norma, between good and evil, and, just as notably, between masculine and feminine. In a way, Norman Bates serves as a nexus for societal fears surrounding gender roles. Norman is coded as feminine in a number of ways. This began with the casting. Before the script was even written, Hitchcock had settled on Anthony Perkins to play the titular psycho. This was a meaningful choice. In the book, Norman is a balding alcoholic in his 40s. By contrast, Perkins was a 27-year-old rising star with a boyish charm and vulnerability. He was also bisexual, and a conscious choice was made to lean into the sexual ambiguity he brought to the role. His mannerisms are gentle and slightly effeminate, especially when compared to the other male characters in the film, who appear more traditionally masculine and assertive. In fact, Norman even takes a submissive role toward the female characters, a total reversal of the era's gender expectations. And, of course, he occasionally dresses in women's clothing. At the end of the film, the psychiatrist explains away Norman's cross-dressing as a product of his split personality. He says, "A man who dresses in woman's clothing in order to achieve a sexual change or satisfaction is a transvestite. But in Norman's case, he was simply doing everything possible to keep alive the illusion of his mother being alive. He tried to be his mother." While that's a fair explanation of Norman's psychology, it's unsatisfying as an answer to the film's gender dynamics. The revelation that the murderous Mrs. Bates is actually Norman is saved until the very end of the film, and then exploited in a moment of maximum shock value. His gender fluidity, one could argue, is presented as the ultimate source of horror. What's troubling isn't simply the idea of a man in a dress. It's the extent of the confusion about where Norman ends and Mother begins. The disruption of gender roles was a source of real fear in the mid-20th century. During World War II, women entered the workforce en masse, taking over jobs that were traditionally held by men. When the men came back from war, they found that women had more social capital than ever before, which threatened their own power. In a way, it threatened the very concept of masculinity. This sentiment led to a backlash against momism, a term coined by Philip Wiley in his 1942 book, A Generation of Vipers. It was believed that overprotective mothering could prevent boys from growing into independent men. Further, Wiley blamed mums at the ballot box for, quote, a new all-time low in moral degeneration, civic corruption, smuggling, bribery, theft, murder, homosexuality, drunkenness, financial depression, chaos, and war. While that might be a slight exaggeration, it cuts to the heart of his argument. The disruption of gender roles was causing massive shifts in society, and to many men, those changes were terrifying. But to admit that men were losing power would be to acknowledge the loss of their own masculinity. Instead, the solution was to blame women. They had overstepped their bounds. They had stripped men of their rightful power. Norma and Norman Bates are a portrait of momism gone horribly wrong. Norman's mother didn't just destroy his masculinity, she dominated him completely until he literally became her. At which point, Norman embodies both sides of the horrifying equation. He is the weak, submissive son devoid of masculine power, and the domineering woman who threatens the men around her. But by subsuming her identity into his, Norman goes beyond simply reversing gender roles. Throughout the story, his identity constantly switches between male and female, disrupting the concept of gender altogether. Mid-century America had no framework for understanding this kind of gender fluidity. The roles of man and woman were rigidly defined. It wasn't until 1959, the year before Psycho's release, that California passed a law protecting the right for women to wear pants. This seems absurd to us today, but we have to understand that the issue was about much more than clothing. Gender defined every aspect of a person's life. Which schools they could attend, which jobs they could hold, how they were treated on a day-to-day, minute-by-minute basis. Allowing people to exist outside of the two traditional categories would threaten the entire social structure. Norman Bates is a personification of this fear. He is the symbol of a society on the verge of chaos, where rules and boundaries are rapidly dissolving. And because we're set up to identify with Norman, the film forces the moviegoers of 1960 to question their traditional attitudes and confront their fears head-on. Because when the credits rolled, they would have to drift back into a reality just as depraved as the world of Psycho. The story was not merely a metaphor. It was based on the life and crimes of a real person. In the 1950s, Ed Gein killed at least two women in Plainfield, Wisconsin, and also exhumed and mutilated a number of corpses from the local cemetery. Just like Norman Bates, Gein's domineering mother was blamed for the psychological problems that led to the murders. And, like the release of Psycho, the media frenzy surrounding Gein's arrest sparked a collective fear of everything that was once considered safe. Psycho writer Robert Bloch lived in small-town Wisconsin, not far from Gein's House of Horrors. What inspired him most about the story was the idea that a ghoulish killer with perverted appetites could flourish almost openly in a small, rural community where everybody prides himself on knowing everybody else's business. Thanks for listening to Villains. We'll be back next week with our episode on Ed Gein. You can find all episodes of Villains and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Villains, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Villains on Spotify, just open the app and type Villains in the search bar. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. I'll see you next time. Villains was created by Max Cutler. It is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler with sound design by Trent Williamson. Production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Joel Stein, and Carly Madden. This episode of Villains was written by Kate Gallagher. I'm Alastair Murden.